We need an intelligent, articulate, good-looking, spiritual giant speaker. I'm like, yeah. He goes, that dude's really busy. What are you doing? I'm like, really? I'm like, are you kidding me? And then I get here, and what Jason says to me, he goes, you're the last guy. And actually, somebody else heard it, right? Where is he? So you're the last guy on the list. I'm like, really? Thanks, man. I feel great. So nonetheless, I'm glad to be here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it was like now in a general way, right? I'm going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and more specifically what that's had as an impact on my life. And I'm really fortunate my friend Dan here came. So Dan and I have been friends. Dan is not an alcoholic as far as I know. I don't even think Dan drinks, but I would not call Dan normie. I'd call him non-alcoholic, right? Normal, not quite sure, Dan, but neither here nor there. So the reason it's so important and so lucky for me that Dan's here, two reasons. One is Dan and I used to do a lot of off-roading together. And if you go off-roading, that means we sit in the truck together for 16 hours as we drive to Utah. Then we sit in the truck together for 3 days as we off-road. Then we sit in the truck and we camp together in the same tent. Then we sit in the truck for 16 hours back. A lot of talking. And the other reason I'm really fortunate is Dan doesn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And so at the end of this, I get to say, what did you learn? And I'll find out if I actually did a good job of carrying the message. Because if he says things like, oh, there's something like go to meetings and eat donuts and that'll keep you sober, then I know I failed. Or if he says things like, oh, doing push-ups will keep you sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know I failed. Or he said something, AA is about barbecues and that's it, then I know I failed. So I'm really lucky to be able to ask Dan on the way home, hey, what did you learn about AA? So really fortunate, great example. The other thing I want to tell you guys is, you may not like me. That's okay. I'm an acquired taste. Not everybody likes me. Most people don't like me. And that's fine. So Alcoholics Anonymous is not represented only by Noah. I happen to just be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll do my best to share what's happened to me. If you don't like me, there's another meeting tomorrow night. There's another meeting. This meeting happens monthly. There's a speaker meeting Sunday night for sure. There's one next Saturday night. There's a lot of meetings around. Go to another speaker meeting. Go to another meeting and listen to somebody else, right? Not every two people who come into AA match. So don't, if you don't like me, please don't let that turn you off from Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Hear the message when you can. So last thing really quick I want to tell you is that anything I say up here, I'm going to try my best to stay away from opinion, and I will share with you my experience. I will try really hard not to do opinions, right? I'll share with you what I've done and my experience. Now, every once in a while, I'll sprinkle in there a little quote, and if it's a quote from the big books, then it's actually my opinion and the opinion of the first 100 men and women, so at least we can have a discussion with more than just me involved in it, right, which is really good. So I'm going to tell you a few stories, and we'll kind of go from there. So first of all, one of my earliest memories is my mom's telling me, I'm a little kid, and she's telling me the story about my dad who had a girlfriend who was a witch. And apparently my dad and this witch girlfriend were going to cook me as a baby. I'm not exactly sure why, but they wanted to cook me as some, I don't know, religious thing. And my mom saved me. So first memory is hey, you're going to get cooked. So do you think that getting cooked as a baby is why I'm an alcoholic? Okay, let's go on a little further. So the first time I broke into a house, the first time I committed residential burglary was when I was in the second grade with my mom's boyfriend named Cody, who practiced black magic, who spent a bunch of time teaching me. You can already see there's like this whole black magic theme that's going to happen, which is really funny considering where I'm standing, but neither here nor there. And so he taught me how you can turn the handle and kick the deadbolt in. Now, I wasn't strong enough to do it, but I learned a technique really early, and I've become a great thief as a result of that, or at least in my own mind. Fast forward, you guys think because I broke into my first house in the second grade, that's why I'm an alcoholic? Okay, let's keep going. In the fourth grade, my mom had a boyfriend named Mark, whose nickname was Gator. His claim to fame was that he was a convicted murderer and beat a man to death in the street for running into his wife with a taxi. He pulled the taxi driver out, beat him to death. And so I'm hanging out with him, and what he taught me is that if you go and all the tramps go to the mall, then the tramp camp, at least in Florida, right, there's all these tents, they're abandoned. You can go take anything you want out of their camps. Usually there's some good stuff, right? So fourth grade, right, I went and learned that you can rob the tramp camp. Do you think because in the fourth grade, instead of going to school, I'm running around robbing tramp camps, that makes me an alcoholic? Nope. One time, so I love this because we can talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and singleness of purpose, but one time I stayed up for several days, I don't know, somewhere between 4 and 7, it kind of gets a little blurry in there, and through a good crank-smoking drug-induced psychosis, the hand of the devil actually touched me in this big fog right in front of the mission. It was the single scariest, actually, I got to stop talking about it, single scariest thing that's ever happened to me. The hand of the devil touched my heart. That's like bad stuff, right? Do you think that's what made me an alcoholic? Yeah. How about the crank? You think that made me an alcoholic? So the reason I'm going through this is I want to be really specific. I stood up here and I said, my name is Noah and I am an alcoholic. I personally am an alcoholic because I'm suffering from the malady called alcoholism. which has two parts, as I understand it, really specifically, right? One is that I have a physical allergy to alcohol. I don't react. My friend Dan is a non-alcoholic. Let's just assume that's the case, right? Or my wife Rebecca is definitely a non-alcoholic. She reacts differently to alcohol than I do. When I drink alcohol, I get this thing called the phenomenon of craving. Dr. Silkworth talks about it. He calls it the phenomenon of craving. Now, I didn't know that word before I came to AA. Like, I'd never heard. I don't even think I could say phenomena, right? But here's what I did know. I knew that once I started drinking, it's on. And it's been like that my entire life. In fact, I reacted differently than other people from the first time I drank to the last time I drank. They would say things. Man, I remember one time, even I was pretty young. I must have been like 14 years old, maybe 15. I was talking to my buddy, Johnny Turner. And he said, I got to go home. And I remember thinking like, yeah, me too. And then kept drinking. It's not like the thoughts that I should stop never happen. The problem is, once I start drinking, it's on. So let me give you an example. So I'm French-Canadian. I'm really originally from Quebec. So up there, I had a friend named Gilles, my neighbor. Gilles is allergic to bees, right? So one time, we're out there drinking, and the bee stings him in his foot. Poof, his foot swells up almost the size of a football instantly, okay? Do you think his foot swelled up because he's immature, or maybe his dad doesn't love him, or he owes back taxes, or has a girlfriend on the side, or anything like that? No, right? His foot swelled up because he's allergic to the toxin in the little bee stinger. I'm not allergic to bees. The bee stings me, I flick it off, no big deal. It stings a little, I move on my way. However, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm allergic to alcohol. When I take a drink of alcohol, my body reacts independent of my thinking. It's not because I owe back taxes or my dad doesn't love me or I'm immature or I have a girlfriend on the side. I react and lose control of the amount I'm going to drink because I'm an alcoholic and I am allergic to alcohol. I'm an alcoholic. I can't help it. My wife isn't. She does not react the same way I do. And I knew this before I ever came to AA. I didn't know these fancy words. I couldn't articulate it this well. But I knew that once I started drinking, it's on. That's why I spent so much time trying to not drink instead of trying to moderate my drinking. I was always trying to not drink because I knew once it starts, I heard a guy say it one time, he goes, how do I say it? Oh, when you get hit by a train, it's not the caboose that kills you. I'm like, yeah, I get it. Once I start, it's on. And, you know, this phenomenon of craving for an alcoholic of my type happens completely independent of my thinking. I'll give you an example. So Dan knows, and Jason knows, right? And so I have two girls, Becca, who's about that big, and Sarah's about that big, 13 and 6. And if you know me for more than 45 seconds, you know I adore my daughters, right? I just adore my daughters. Knock wood, this doesn't happen. But let's say that I flopped right out of this box, and I fell down right over there, and I started having a heart attack, right in front of you guys, right there. And everybody, in perfect unison and harmony, right, says, stop having a heart attack. Think of the children. And started singing, right? We're in church, singing, awesomeness. Do you think it would be sufficient for me to just stop having a heart attack? Could I just think myself out of it? And we all know the answer is no, right? If I could think myself out of a heart attack, if people could do that, they would, right? Very few people would think, hey, this is a great idea. Run with it, right? We would think ourselves out of it. The problem is that once I start drinking, the phenomenon of craving develops for an alcoholic of my type, it doesn't matter what I think anymore. I've had these thoughts like, I should stop. Hey, bad stuff's going to happen. Hey, you should go home. Hey, I'll be there in a little bit. Yeah, yeah. Once I start drinking, it's on. And one of the most happy, unhappy things that's ever happened to me is start drinking and again get interrupted, right? That is horrible. I remember sitting in jail in Red Deer, Alberta, and I'm sitting there, and I'm drunk enough to not be sober, but not drunk enough to be drunk. And I'm just like, oh, I just remember. And somebody had told me, watch what happens when you get arrested before you're drunk. It sucks. And I remember sitting there and I'm like, it does. I mean, it sucks anyway, but I mean, it double sucks, right? It's like miserable. So there you go. First part of alcoholism, I'm allergic to alcohol. I react differently than non-alcoholics. So here's the big problem for a guy like me. The question is, why do I keep taking a drink? And this is the second part of the malady of alcoholism. This is what almost killed me personally. And it's called the insanity of the first drinker, the obsession of the mind. So right here, sitting here tonight, so one of my favorite drinks, so like my favorite well-known stage of the spree are pretty straightforward. It's not sexy at all. Half a pint of Kamikaze, half a pint of Long Island iced tea, a 40 of Old English, a fifth of Bacardi rum poured in a 2-liter bottle of Coke, an 8-ball of cocaine, a fight, and somebody beat me up by the end of the night. Ooh, party's on. Well-known stage of the spree. It's not very sexy or exciting, right? But I could tell you exactly how it goes, right? The question is, why is it when I made a decision to not drink, I couldn't stop drinking? So one day I wake up. So I come to you. I look around, I'm like, oh man, I'm in my room. I look over and there's my motorcycle helmet. It's got grass all in the grill. I'm like, oh man, that's a bummer. Not that uncommon, but it's still a bummer nonetheless, right? You got grass in your grill, that's not good. I look at the back of the helmet and there's a scratch, I don't know, probably like 5 to 6 inches long and about 1/4 inch deep. So you know, if you've ever scratched a helmet. I mean, to get a quarter inch deep in your helmet means you hit your head pretty hard. And I'm like, oh, that's not super awesome, right? That means that there's something wrong with my motorcycle, right? So, cool. So I look in the other corner of my room, and there's a pile of stereo equipment. Again, not that uncommon for me, right? I'm a thief, so it's not that uncommon. So there's a turntable, and there's a tape player, and there's a receiver and some speakers. But everything is soaking wet. I'm like, oh, that's a little weird, right? Like, okay, cool. And as I'm kind of collecting myself, I think to myself, this is it. This is ridiculous. How am I living? I feel bad. I feel horrible. I'm like, I don't know what happened. I don't know what's going on. I don't want to live this way. And so I swing my legs over the side of my bed, and I say, you know what? That's it. I'm not drinking anymore. So I leave my house. I'm not drinking. I'm like, okay, today don't drink. And I'm walking. And I had the greatest job on the planet Earth at one point. I worked by myself at night in a liquor store. Right? I was in Maria Market in Santa Barbara. Awesome. The girl who lived behind the store sold me crank, and the guy who lived across the thing sold me cocaine. And they sold as a term meaning they could shop for free and I got what I want, right? So it's like this giant, like, you know, it was like a great job. I got there early, stayed late, slept in the back half the time. It was awesome. And I would go, and there's a story in the Big Book that this guy's name is Fred. And Fred, he goes out of town for business, and he talks about, as I stepped over the threshold, the thought occurred to me, right? And I know what that is like, to go from being convinced in every fiber of my body that I'm not going to drink to all of a sudden, only thing I can focus on is drinking. And my first sponsor said, Noah, that's called the obsession of the mind. And the way he explained it to me is he said, an obsession is one thought that pushes every other thought out of your mind. And I know what that's like. I'm looking down. I'm not going to drink. I step in. I'm like, put half a pint of kamikaze in the cooler now. It'll be chilled in 10 minutes. Like, I don't even know how it just happens. Right here in my sane mind, my non-alcoholic mind, I can make the decision. If you put half a pint of kamikaze right here on one side of the triple bean scale, and you put the relationship with my two girls on the other side, right? No problem. I can make that decision. You could put 20 of those things. You could put a case of Old English. It isn't worth it. Doesn't matter what you put. In my sane mind, I can make it. The problem is, when the obsession of the mind's on me, the obsession of alcohol, I can't make that equation. I say stupid things like, one thing's got nothing to do with the other. Dude, it's just a half pint of kamikaze. This time is going to be different. Why would I rest? No, I see the pitfalls. Why would I go down that path? I've learned my lesson. I say the dumbest things. And then the next morning I wake up going, oh my God, I'll do anything not to be this way again. And I go through my little day, and then I'm like, I'm not going to do that again. I don't know, maybe this is just me. It may sound familiar to you. That's been my experience. So I'm a tough guy. And so I don't know, let's see if there's any other tough guys. We'll pick on Tom. I know Tom's a tough guy for sure. So we'll pick on Jason. So a couple guys I know. So if you're a good tough guy, you run out into the world and you barbecue your life. At least if you're a tough guy of my variety. You run out to the world and you basically just hit face first into the world, right? And when everything else falls apart and you've got no more money and you've got nowhere else to go and everything's bottoming out, where do you go? You go to mom's house. That's where I go, right? And so I go to my mom's house, and coincidentally, I almost always show up at my mom's house on Sunday evenings. I don't know why it is. So I go to my mom's house, and I knock on the door, and I go, Mom, can I come in? And she goes, yeah, of course you can come in, but there's some rules. You understand, I'm my mother's firstborn child, and then my mom got sober, right? And then I was not sober, and so she would do anything she could to help me get sober, right? You can come in, but there's some rules. No cussing, no fighting, no drinking, no drugging. I'm like, okay, Mom. And, you know, sometimes I wasn't very sincere, and I just needed somewhere to go. And other times I meant it. And so I'd go in there, and it's just amazing to me how close to the obsession of mine killed me. So I'll give you an example. You guys saw there were some cookies out there on the tray when you walked in? I love cookies, right? I don't eat a cookie. I mean, I always calculate, like, caloric intake of cookies by the carton, right? Like, I eat all the cookies out there. So I'll give you an example. If I go and I run down and I shoot out the back door and I go get a cookie and run back, other than you guys thinking I'm a little bit weird and really like cookies, there's no real consequences, right? Like nobody's going to, like that guy right there, the big guy, you're not going to hit me, are you? I mean, you might think I'm a kook, but you're not going to like stab me on the way by. Right? There's no real consequences. But yet, I'm easily able to control my desire for the cookie. No consequences. I can control my desire. So here I am. I'm at my mom's house. I've been living under a bridge in San Roque neighborhood of Santa Barbara for the last 7 days, eating nothing but olives out of cans because I stole a bunch of canned olives, so that's what you eat. I got nowhere to go. I wish I was dead, right? I hate my life. I hate everything about my life. And the only thing I have to do is not drink in order to have a place to live. Not a lot to ask. And what almost killed me and what I couldn't figure out is, why can't I make the decision not to drink stick? I can make the decision not to eat the cookies stick. I guarantee you I will not eat a cookie before I leave this property. Guarantee you. And zero consequences can make it stick. Huge consequences for taking a drink. And I make the decision to not drink, and I can't make it stick. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I thought I had gone insane. I thought that when the hand of the devil touched me, that I had a little bit of brain damage that occurred simultaneously, and that there was something that I actually needed that I had fried. I didn't know what was wrong with me. So there we go, and I'm going through the world, and I'm trying everything I can to not drink. So, for example, I'll give you some few things of what I tried to do to stop drinking. So I obviously tried the basic ones, right, drinking different things. I thought if I just drink Old English and I don't drink the Bacardi, that will work. I tried hanging out with different people. So I hung out with all these black dudes. That didn't work. They were all like the gangsters. So then I hung out with all these SA guys. I thought it worked. So then I hung out with all the white supremacist dudes. That didn't work. They're all just knuckleheads. So that didn't work. I left the country because I figured the problem was here, people in Santa Barbara. And, you know, only a sissy goes halfway up the state. So I left the country. Not once, but twice. That didn't work. I tried hanging out. I met this girl named Brooke, really strong with the church, just really beautiful inside and out. And I thought, gosh, if I hang out with a really cool church person, then I'll start going to church, right? And then church people don't act the way I'm acting, so that'll rub out. That didn't work out, right? So that's just a whole other bad story. So I tried everything I could to stop drinking, and it wasn't working. So let me just fast forward. So here we go. I'm drinking, and I'm not a particularly, I mean, it's Saturday night, so I got to tell you one stupid story, because otherwise Tom will say, you didn't tell any stupid stories, and I don't want to hear Tom saying that. So here, I'll tell you one stupid story. So just to put things in perspective, what type of tough guy I am. So I'm determined, my goal in life, I had two goals in life. One was to join the Hells Angels, and the second one was to be an international cat burglar. Those were my two aspirations growing up. And if that's the way you said no plan B, I had a plan B, right? So if one doesn't work out, either way, you know, Ventura's not far, boom, boom, boom. So I'm working on my criminal career. So I decide I'm going to strong arm this liquor store. So you go strong arm, right? Like I'm going to bully the money out of this guy. So I run into the liquor store. Boom, give me all your money. And the guy looks at me. He says, no. And he pushes me. And I fall down. Ugh. There is nothing more ego smashing than being an up-and-coming knucklehead and trying to strong-arm liquor store and getting pushed. So I do the only thing I can to save face and not completely lose my ego, which is I jump up and I grab the Jerry Kids can and I run out the door. So there you go, Tom. That's the type of knucklehead you're dealing with, right? That's like, to me, that's, hey, I'm doing okay still, right? Things aren't that bad, right? So yeah, okay, I've got nowhere to live. I can't stop drinking. I'm counting Jerry Kids money in the park and rolling it. I'm like, okay. Could be worse, right? So I leave Santa Barbara, and I go up to British Columbia. This is the second time I left because I was having a lot of problems with people in Santa Barbara. And the big change for me in Santa Barbara was I thought the change of scenery and the change of people would have a significant impact on the way I drank, and it didn't. I wound up drinking more. I stopped doing drugs, but I wound up drinking more and more and more. And the weird thing that happened to me is I hear people say things like, it stopped working. For a long time, I didn't understand what that meant. So I'll tell you what that means to me. What that meant to me and what it means to me now is that I drank and I got physically drunk. I lost my balance. My hearing got ringing. My eyesight was blurry. Physically drunk. But the one thing that alcohol did for me and had always done for me is it had provided a solution to my fundamental problem. My fundamental problem is I don't know how to live happy and content and sober in this world. Alcohol actually solved the problem. If I wouldn't have started drinking when I started drinking, I'm pretty sure I would have killed myself by that time I was 15, right? Alcohol solved the problem. I felt better when I drank. In fact, I was talking to this guy the other day, and he's pretty new. He's about 18 months sobriety. He's been kind of in a sheltered environment. He's just coming back into his family. And I'm like, hey, man, what'd you do this weekend? He goes, I went around my family. He goes, how was that? He goes, it felt good. And so we started talking, and I said, you know what? You know what good always meant to me? He goes, what? I said, drunk. He goes, yeah. The only time I remember feeling good was drunk to me is what good, like normal people, when they say like, I feel good, to me, that's drunk. That's the solution to the problem. The problem is the rest of the time, right? So I'm up there and I start drinking and I'm drunk and I can't feel good. I can't get drunk enough to get away from the circumstances of my life. I know what the score is. I know who I am. I know the type of things I've done. I know there's no way out. So I'm in British Columbia, and I make the strongest resolution I've ever made in my life. I mean, up until this point and before, never in my life have I made a stronger resolution than that resolution. And that was in August of 1994, and I said, I am never, ever, ever drinking again. I'm done. I'm changing the way I'm living. Now, I had always had this weird feeling that if I could stop drinking, everything else would sort out. Like, I never really thought past stop drinking, right? My whole goal in life was don't drink. But I never actually thought, like, then what? I just thought, don't drink. And since I could never do that, there was really no point in thinking beyond it. So I thought, okay, cool. And I came back to Santa Barbara and I didn't drink. And interestingly enough, I felt worse than I did the day before. And then I didn't drink the next day. And I felt worse. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And I went on like that for about 2 weeks. And every day I felt worse than the day before. The big book talks about we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, right? Every day I was more restless, irritable, discontent, which is actually like nice words. I was just mad. I was angry. I was short-tempered. I was rageful. I'm working in this liquor store. People are asking me things like, how much is this? And I'm just like, oh my gosh, right? And I don't know exactly what happened, but some dude came in who I know, Tom, big guy, ex-biker guy, another Tom, big biker Tom. Anyways, and he came in and he asked me something. I don't know what he said. He said, like, how much is the juicy fruit? I'm like, I'm going to kill you, right? And I grabbed the bottle of pop off and I chase him down the street. I'm like, I'm going to kill you. And he runs away and he's like, oh my God, stupid Noah's crazy. And so I drink the pop off and I get drunk, physically drunk, right? My hearing goes out, my eyesight goes out, my balance goes out, and I'm super clear on the circumstance of my life. And when somebody says alcohol stopped working for me, that's what I equate it to. I could not get drunk enough to feel okay. I was scared. I was angry. I hated being me. I hated the things I'd done. I hated the way people looked at me. You guys remember that? Remember all those conversations where you'd start and people look at you like you're speaking Chinese? You know, you just can't connect to any other. For me, I could not connect to any human being. I was in full free float of the world, right? All I could do, even my kids tease me now after the mantras. The other thing they tease me is, Sarah says, well, you have feelings, scared and mad. I'm like, really? That's what my six-year-old says to me. I'm like, really? And I've been sober quite a while, right? I'm like, come on. I just couldn't plug into the world. So I come back, and here I am. I can't get drunk enough. I'm working this liquor store. Across the street from the liquor store is a really solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's still sober. It's a guy named Mike. And Mike was a stand-up dude. He would come in the liquor store and he'd give me a hard time because him and my mom were buddies, right? And so by now, my mom's freaking out. So there were two guys. There were Noah and Chad. And Noah was drunk and Chad was sober. Chad's mom and Noah's mom sat at the soccer games watching Cody, Chad's little brother, and Luke, Noah's little brother, play soccer. And they'd talk about their kids. And my mom would be crying and I'm afraid he's going to die and I don't know what's going to happen. And Chad's sober. Once that happened, my mom got just... like, I just broke my poor mom's heart. She just got over the top. And so she would talk to Mike. Well, Mike, his job was to keep an eye on me to make sure I didn't kill myself, right? So he'd come to this liquor store. I'd be hungover, and he'd say things like, big guy like Jason, smiley guy like Jason, touchy guy like Jason, little guy. And he'd come in and put his arm, hey, man, how you feeling? Right? If you're new and an AA guy asks you that, like, that's the worst, right? Like, really? Dude, stab you in the knee. But, you know, I was way too scared. So I just stared at his feet and, you know, kind of looked down and, this particular day, he came in and he said, how you doing? And I don't know what I said to him, but I said something to the effect of help or take me to AA or I don't know or I give up. I don't know what I said, the words, you know what I mean? I wasn't taking notes or anything. But he's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, so he scooped me up and he took me to a meeting. I had been to AA meetings before. Maybe you've been to AA meetings before you came to AA this time. I had been to AA meetings before. In fact, I used to take acid and sit in the back of the Alano Club and trip out on people because it's weird in an AA meeting, right? You're like, whoa, those guys are crazy. And yeah, I remember that was a whole nother trip. But so I'd been to AA meetings before. And this time I came in and what happened was I heard somebody carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sure that the message was being carried at these other meetings and I just wasn't ready to hear it. But this time I was ready to hear it. And what I heard this guy say is, he said, if you're new and you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you work the steps as they're laid out in the big book to the best of your ability, he's like, you don't ever have to get loaded again if you don't want to, and your life will get better. And probably a lot like Dan sitting here tonight, I thought to myself, what is he talking about, steps? I don't know what you mean, right? I don't get it. So I went over and I asked that guy, what do you do? And that guy became my sponsor. And we went through the steps in pretty quick order, and I'm super grateful I am so grateful that that guy didn't just let me hang out and eat cookies or just told me to go do push-ups. And he had told me, we have to address the spiritual malady. You're dying. You have alcoholism. And he explained to me the physical aspect and the mental obsession. He said, but you're dying from a spiritual malady. And in my heart, I knew that. I knew that. That's why I was trying to find God. I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't have the words. But now that I look back, I'm like, I knew that. Right, I did things like, I'm not alone, I'm sure that I'm not the only person who's read the Bible cover to cover, right? Take 3 days, sprung out of your mind, looking for the answer, right? Bible cover to cover, tried going to church, always looking for something. And this guy got me into action right away. So here's what we did. We got together, he explained to me what it means to be an alcoholic, and he asked me, do you think you're an alcoholic? I'm like, yeah. And I was relieved to find out that was wrong with me. I thought I had some type of brain damage. So I'm like, oh, it's not brain damage, it's that? Oh, cool, great. Then we talked about the second step. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And he made it really simple for me. He said, listen, Noah. He said, it's only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than yourself. That's all you need to do at the beginning. I said, well, I don't understand. He goes, look, as long as you don't say, no, no way, never, impossible, can't happen, as long as you don't sit there and tell me you're God, if you can say, maybe there's something, he goes, you're in, we'll get the rest later. I'm like, cool. So I could do that. So then we got to the third step, which says, made a decision to turn our will and our life for the care of God as we understand him. And I said, So he made it really simple. He goes, no, do you think God can do a better job of running your life than you can? That was the question. And before I could answer, mean guy, he cocks back and he hits me, pow, right? My sponsor and I weren't buddies. We were never buddies. We're not buddies. If he walked in right now, I would start sweating. I'd feel extremely uncomfortable. He hit me, boom, and he goes, let me tell you something, punk. He goes, from where I sit, a monkey could do a better job than you've done. And the truth was, he's right, right? You think about those little wind-up monkeys, you know, the little symbol ones? They're consistent, right? That's already way better than I'm doing, right? And so I'm like, yeah, probably. And we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And it was awkward. I had never prayed, certainly not with another man. I didn't know what I was doing, but I meant the best that I can. Whatever is there, I finally got to the point in my life that whatever's behind door number two is better than what I have here. And up until that point, I wouldn't look behind door number two. As long as I thought, I'm scared of what's over there, maybe I can polish the turd just a little bit more, right? I was willing to stick with it. It was only that I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I was willing to look behind door number two. So I got up and he read something to me. He said, although our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And he says, what do you think at once means? I said, and he hit me. Pow, sit down. So I sat down and we started the fourth step. So the fourth step, the way I did it, has 11 columns. 4 columns on the resentment inventory, 3 columns on the fear inventory, and 4 columns on the sexual inventory. And what he explained to me we were doing is he explained to me that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. The root. There's tons of other problems, but the root is that. And that we were going to take an inventory of my life specifically looking for the most common manifestations of self. Resentments. Because I'm mad at you, so I drink the poison and wait for you to die, just consume, cut off from God. Fear, no faith, right? Just totally, you're going to take something I have or I'm not going to get something I want. And my sexual inventory, because there's nothing like a nice dysfunctional relationship to bring out selfishness, right? Wow, denial group. Okay, cool. So moving on. So we do that, right? And for me, it wasn't really that hard. And probably because I wasn't firing on all 8, like I couldn't talk very well for the first 6 to 9 months, right? So I was just barbecued. I mean, my brain was barbecued. So probably I didn't hear a lot of meanings, the scariness of the 4 steps. I don't know if you guys have this here, but every once in a while you get somebody who comes to these fear mongers and they start saying things like, oh my gosh, the 4 steps really scary. And it's usually a misinterpretation of something somebody never did or understood in the first place. For me, the 4 step was really easy. He said, make a list of people you're resentful at. And I don't know how your life was, but that's all I had left in my life. The only thing I had was people I resented. I see Jason on the street, he's like, what's up? I'm like, you know what, man, that dude's a punk. And that's all I had. It's not like I was saying anything like, you know, the kids are growing. Hey, it's great to see you guys. Hey, I heard you moved. Hey, cool house. I went to school. All I had in my life was, you know, that dude's a punk. Ah, he stole my thing. So when you asked me to make a list, it wasn't hard for me. So I made the list and we went through it and then I shared the fifth step with him. I sat down and I read him all these things, right? It says, admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. And he said to me, my job in this is to be a human being. I'm like, okay, cool. And we read all that type of stuff. Then he asked me, Noah, those are the things that are blocking you off from a power greater than yourself. Are you willing to let go of them? And for the most part, I was really concerned about the lying part, right? I told you my aspiration in life is to be a thief. So if you're not lying and stealing, I don't really, you know, like, how are you going to meet girls, like, you know, if you can't lie? I don't understand how that's going to work, right? How are you going to make money if you can't steal? Like, I don't get it, right? But yeah, I don't want to live this way. So I did it. We said another prayer to seven step. Then I took all the names on my resentment inventory. I stuck them on a new sheet of paper. And then I added everybody I'd harmed. And that was my eight step list. And for me, I was really fortunate. That was one day. It was a long day. I got to a shop early in the morning. I went to a 6:45 meeting. At 7:45, I went to a shop. And I left late at night. And I had my list. And I went out in the world and I started making amends. And the reason that I'm so grateful for that man for doing it that way for me is that I don't have what you would call a lot of endurance, right? Left unchecked, I go from kind of spiritually okay and happy, healthy to suicidal in about 3 days. I don't have like buffer. If you told me things like to me, like the concept of rock through your feelings is a death sentence. Like just sit there and rock through it. I'm like, oh my God, I don't think you understand. I might kill you before I kill myself just for saying that, right? Like I just don't survive well. And this guy recognized that in me and he got me in a solution quick, which I'm not saying is for everybody, but for me, I'm really grateful it was that way, right? He got me into it and then he got me into action. A couple of the other things he taught me pretty quick was he taught me about how to act in a meeting because I didn't know, right? So there was a lot of yelling. This, again, these aren't buddy relationships. Like I went to this guy's house. He was my sponsor for 8 years. I went to his house one time, and it's because his wife invited me without him knowing for a dinner party, and he was mad when he came home and found me there. He was, why are you in my house? I'm like, oh, dude, really? So if you're not buddy-buddy with your sponsor, that's okay. At least that's been my experience, not required. But he taught me some other things. Like sometimes we hear the steps grouped into four, right? Like submission, admission, restitution, and maintenance, right? We talk about the maintenance steps, right? 10, 11, 12, maintenance steps. And he explained to me pretty early on. He's like, really? Think about this, Noah. He goes, you've been sober 30 days. Are you in maintenance mode? He goes, growth. Those are the growth steps. Growth starts from there. And I had never thought about what happens once I stop drinking. Like, how do you live? I had no, people would ask me, what are your hobbies? I'm like, I've never done anything. I didn't play Little League Baseball. I didn't play any sports. I played the band for, I think, 3 weeks. I'm a high school dropout. I'm not even a particularly good thief. I don't know anything about cars. I don't know anything about science. Look at the stars. I can barely understand what they are. I don't know anything. I don't lift weight. I have zero hobbies. And I come in AA, I have no idea. Fun to me literally means half a pint of Kamikaze, half a pint of Long Island iced tea, a 40 of Old English, an 8-ball, a fifth of Bacardi, probably breaking your house, trying to find some chick to have sex with, and a fight. To me, that is fun. That's all I knew. And he told me, dude, growth starts from here. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been really fantastic. So first there's the fellowship, right? The going to barbecues, the going to meetings, the going to conferences. That stuff is awesome. And have friends that I didn't have before and all of the support. And that is awesome. And that's one part of the equation. For me, that was really important, right? But the fundamental thing that changed my position in the universe was the steps and the actions, right? The fellowship's fun, and I'm not bagging on it. It's fantastic. I love it. I still have a fellowship around me that I really enjoy. But the actions would let my life start to fundamentally change, right? I am not the guy I used to be. Now, I'm certainly not the guy I hope to be, right? And I'm not the guy I want to be, but I am not the guy I used to be. Everything in my life has changed. In fact, if you think about it this way, the only thing that has been constant since 1994 when I got sober, the only thing that has been constant is my relationship with God. I don't look the same, right? I'm 20 years older than I was. I don't act the same. I haven't been married for 20 years, so it's not her. I didn't have kids. I don't drive the same car. I don't live in the same house. I don't wear the same clothes. Nothing except for my relationship with God has been the constant, right? And the only way for a guy like me, and I think Dan actually teased this out of me about halfway back from Moab, and he said to me very astutely, he said, Noah, what did AA do for you? And I looked at Dan, I said, you know what, Dan? I said, AA introduced me to God, and it let me live a new life. Thanks for letting me share.